You're listening to Rendezvous with
Welcome, welcome to Rendezvous with a Writer, where readers and writers meet,
and story is everything.
We're your hosts tonight, Jim and Bobby Bell.
And we're so delighted you're joining us again this week, whether you might be listening live, watching, or joining us on a podcast down the road. We are so happy to have you with us. And that was the Hot Texas Swing Band starting us off by our good friend Alex Dormont and the Hot Texas Swing Band. Jim. Who is our special guest tonight?
Special guest, Kathleen Morris.
There she is. Hi, Kathleen.
Hey, good evening. Good evening.
Welcome, welcome. We're so happy you're with us.
Me too.
We're going to imagine that there's just this fabulous landscape behind you, Kathleen. We're so happy you're with us.
Our imagination for that.
Yes, absolutely. Do you want to...
We have a short bio.
A short bio.
I can read.
Okay.
Go for it.
Kathleen Morris loves American and Western history. She is a graduate of Prescott College in Arizona and lives and writes in the desert Southwest. She loves being able to immerse herself in the lives of her characters, especially bringing to life the charismatic women of the West, both real and imaginary. Meticulous research and dedication to detail are the hallmarks of her work. Her debut novel, Lily of the West, won the Peace Picker Award for Best First Western Novel. Her next titles, The Wind at Her Back, The Transformation of Chastity James, and the short story, Mary Mary, Quite Contrary, are award winners. Welcome, Kathleen.
And tonight we're talking about this wonderful new book, her newest gold digger, the legendary Nellie Cashman. Please welcome Kathleen Morris. Welcome. So, Kathleen, you want to tell us a little bit more about yourself and your writing career and maybe how you got started?
Oh, I've kind of been writing since I was 8 years old. But life gets in the way, you know, and you get married, you have a few kids, you work, and you think, well, I don't have time to write today, maybe next week or next year. But finally, I did, and I started my own editing and writing company, copywriting and doing, you know, coaching for other writers, because I was also teaching at Phoenix College. I was teaching writing there. And I was fooling around with a few things, but finally finished a novel that wasn't very good. I don't think anybody's first one is very good. that hasn't seen the light of day for a while. And, you know, a couple others. I wrote a diet and food book, but under a different name. So finally got around to writing Lily of the West, and then it really started to click.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, Lily, very quickly, Lily of the West, who was your main character in that book?
Big Nose Kate Haroney, who was Doc Holliday's lover. And she was much maligned in all the movies and things you see about her as being this prostitute, this horrible woman. But actually, she was extremely well-educated. She was Hungarian. She spoke 5 languages. She was... much, much more than just a prostitute, which was something that she did occasionally, but that wasn't really what defined her. I thought, you know what? She needs a better story. I wrote her one.
And the book that we're going to talk about tonight, I'm going to hold it up again, Gold Digger, the legendary Nellie Cashman, as I wrote in some of our Facebook social promos. When Jim and I went to Tombstone the first few times in the early 1990s, and we had finally moved west and we were trying to see what we could see with limited time, Tombstone was one of the first places we wanted to go to. And it seemed like Nellie's name was on label copy here and there. And I kept thinking, well, who is this woman? Who is this woman? And I couldn't really find very much. So thank you for writing this book, because I feel like I finally got to meet Nellie Cashman.
I hope I've done her justice.
Yeah. How did she come to your attention?
She came to my attention through a friend. I have a good friend, she passed away in January, Kate Brophy. And the Brophys have a ranch called the Baba Comery down in Elgin, near Sonoyta. And we would spend a lot of time down there because it's a wonderful, wonderful. Mm. And I would stay there and we would run around the whole county and area on Bisbee, Tombstone, doing research on for Kate, for Lily of the West, and and the Brophy family. I did three books for them. So it just kind of came out of that, because Kate always wanted me to write about Nellie Cashman. And her nephew Michael married into the Brophy family back in the 1800s, the late 1800s, and the families were very close. And Shelley said, nobody ever does anything good about this, and she had all this material. So I finally gave in and said, okay, I'll read it, I'll see. So, and I got fascinated too.
Did you, I know you have some questions.
Well, you know, I want to ask a kind of a research question. We're talking about research now to a degree, because sometimes it falls into our later on in our interview. But you had to do, for the book, you had to do a lot of research. I know you did a lot with the family. They gave you information. They gave you some pictures and some documents. But you had a lot of characters in this book that you needed to research. We're talking about, you know, now we're talking about Tombstone. We're talking about the different cities that that Nellie went to. And we're talking about the Earps and all these characters. And
other miners.
Talk about British Columbia. We're talking about Alaska. How long did all that take?
To do all that research?
Well, to do all of that, actually the whole book took me about a year and a half to write. And but you know, the research wasn't as bad as it might have been for somebody from, say, New York, because I already knew a lot of these places very well. And I'd also researched quite a few of these characters for other books I have written. So it was not completely foreign to me in any way. I knew Vancouver. I knew Seattle. I've lived in Seattle. San Francisco. I knew Tombstone. I knew Tucson. So it wasn't, you know, it wasn't out of the blue that I had to find all this out. And like I said, I'd already read many of the characters. So,
Were there some challenges that you did have writing the book?
Oh, definitely. She is not an easy woman to find out about. I had to write to Alaska Historical Society, the Arizona Historical Society. I spent a lot of time, you know, in the Cochise County and in Bisbee and looking stuff up. I had to go back into the records of birth and death and all this for her sister. All these things, and the nephews and the nieces too. It took a lot of time. You know, I've actually been to some of the houses they've lived in. So,
wow.
Yeah, it was, Well, having access to the historical stuff from the Brophy's and the O'Fallon's was really a major coup, having that to, as a starting point.
Mm-hmm. You know, the little bit that we saw, yeah, a label copy that I made reference to, she just sounded like a Wonder Woman. You know, she was saving people here and there and just, you know, different things. And I remembered thinking, really, really? And if that's true about her, then again, why wouldn't there be more written about her? Did you, were you a little skeptical in the beginning but then became a fan as you went along?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And in fact, when Kate first talked to me about writing this, I said, she's just too good to be true. Nobody is that good. She's, yeah, got flaws. I can't write a story about somebody with no flaws. I mean, really?
No. Yeah.
I thought, well, I need to learn more. And I also said, I cannot do this as a straight biography. Absolutely not. Not in 100 years. She's got to have flaws. And if she didn't have them, I'm going to give her some.
Well, it is written in the first voice, in the first person. So you had to find her voice, didn't you?
Yes, I did. And I really struggled with that for the first, the first draft, the first 3 months I started writing her. And then all of a sudden, it was like this epiphany. I thought, no, I get it. I get it. She's got flaws. I'm just going to be sure I find them. And I'm going to let everybody know about them. Because we all do.
Yeah.
We all do, no matter how wonderful we might look in a historical record or, you know, on TV or something. Believe me, there's skeletons under that.
No. It seems like there always is, doesn't it?
Well, and I thought it was, yeah, interesting that you would choose, yeah, to use gold digger in the title, because we all, you know, we automatically, yeah, have some type of definition in our mind of what is that. Then we follow it though with the legendary, you know, Nellie Cashman, so we know, okay, this must have a different interpretation. And right, her life really seems like an antithesis of what we might think of as a gold digger. But she kind of was a gold digger, wasn't she?
Literally. Yeah.
Literally.
I had a whole bunch of different titles that I ran through. And two of my sons are writers too. And I said, I don't know what to do with this title. I got to find something snappy here. And they're like, well, what do you want? I said, well, how about Gold Digger? And they're like, no way, no way. No, nobody's going to get that. It sounds like she's some gangster in mall. And I said, yeah, that's exactly what we need to do. Maybe we need to make it the opposite, mm-hmm, of what she is, because, mm-hmm, grab you. So, mm-hmm,
that's what I did. Yeah. Well, we're going to take a very quick break and let our listeners and our watchers know where they can find this book and all of your others, Kathleen, at bookshop.org, our affiliate page. And when we come back, we are going to get more directly involved in Nellie's story. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. Story is everything. Find a great one. On the menu, choose Shop Out West on Rendezvous with a Writer. Explore curated book lists for great gifts. Use the search box to find
Welcome back. Welcome back to Rendezvous with a Writer, where readers and writers meet. Special guest tonight, Kathleen Morris. We're talking about Gold Digger, the life story of
The legendary
Nellie Cashman.
Yeah, it is a life story, though.
What gets her over here? Because she's really, Nellie's really over there, and she's born in Ireland. So what gets her to this country?
Necessity, plain and simple. I think so many Irish emigrated during An Gortaithe Mór, which is the Great Death, the famine that affected Ireland at that time. Right. Potatoes went bad, as we know.
Right.
So her father had already died.
Okay.
Just her mother and her sister. So the mother took her two little girls and got on a ship and said, "This is it. We're out of here." So they came to America and they just figured they had to survive no matter what. Her mother was a seamstress and she taught Fanny, Nellie's sister, how to make lace and decorations. So they were a good team. She had nimble fingers. And Nellie got jobs all over the place. She was an elevator operator. She worked in a factory. She did all sorts of things, but she wasn't much of a seamstress, you know. But we're already finding out that Nellie's a little different.
She is a little different. Now,
yeah.
When they first came to Boston, where they settled, they weren't really welcome, though, were they?
Not really. I don't. Yeah. Not fond of the Irish. It was no Irish need apply.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What year? What years are we talking about?
1860, 1862, 1865.
Yeah.
And yeah, right after the end of the Civil War. That's
Her mom is quite entrepreneurial, and it seems like Nellie has that gift too, doesn't she?
Oh, definitely. I would say so. I mean, you had to live by your wits. You had to figure it out. Nobody was going to do it for you as an immigrant to this country. And I think that's what makes this country so great, is that thinking, you know, that entrepreneurial spirit, that gumption to make it work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, these are tough ladies. I mean, the mother obviously was very resolute, and the children, you know, and both girls. I mean, they both grew up the same way.
They're three remarkable women.
We know Nellie's a little ahead of the pack when it comes to, you know, superwomen, but the other two were no slouches.
Yeah.
No, they definitely were not.
Yeah. And they head for San. At some point, they decide, and I don't remember exactly why, they wanted something better, and they headed for San Francisco.
Yes. Well, Nellie seemed to be the catalyst there. And there's a story, which I didn't use because it's hard to verify some of these, and it's so cliche. She was working as an elevator operator in a hotel, and supposedly Ulysses S. Grant was in the elevator with her and said, "Go west, young woman."
It's kind of like Horace Greeley, you know?
Oh, my God.
So I'm thinking, and you can read that story in many places, and I thought, I don't know.
Well, I don't know either. I did see that. I did see that story, and I wondered, but I knew that you kind of questioned it, or you would have put it in the book. So,
well, I didn't necessarily question it. I just felt that it had been overdone anyway, and I wasn't really sure. No. So, yeah.
So they get to San Francisco.
Yep, going up.
Yeah.
Through the canal, or across the isthmus at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And they get to a boarding house, and they're amazed to find out that the Irish aren't quite as vilified in the other coast as they were on the east. Hey, welcome, every man for himself. We're all in this together. So it worked out much better.
Yeah. She also seems to have... There's so many interesting things about her. One is what I would call, this was such an interesting read, by the way, Kathleen. We haven't said that actually to you yet. Readers and listeners, this is a really, really interesting read. And you really want to know her story, and you really want to know what happens next. She has kind of a sixth sense about things. She certainly sort of knows where to put a business and how to find people that can help run that business, delegate to, that stay with her like their whole lifetimes. And she has a sixth sense about looking at a mining claim and kind of knowing, she studies it a bit, but kind of having a feeling for, this is where I'm going to begin to dig, you know?
Uh-huh.
And she just seems to have this, it's not mystical. That's too far-fetched, but there's just something like sort of magical about how she looks at the world and minds it.
Yeah, in a way it is. You know, she knew right away that she didn't want to work in a shoe factory. She didn't want to do these things. So she started, and a lot of the men that came to the boarding house they lived at were miners who had come and gone on different claims. And she talked to them all, and she would go read the mining newspapers, which came out every week, about new finds and where and why this worked and why it didn't. And she followed these devotedly, and she educated herself on all these things. And she was also very aware, after trying going to Reno and then going up to Virginia City, working in a restaurant, she learned that the richest man in town, aside from the big mining companies, was the guy that owned the restaurant she worked in. And so when you have mining, you have to support your miners. And they always need food. They always need supplies. They always need boots. They always need pans and pickaxes. And she knew that right away. Mm-hmm. That even if you don't find that particular rich vein, you can support yourself with equipment. Mm-hmm.
She got the fever. She got the itch. Oh, she'd hear them talking about a strike, and she just, you know, she really wanted to go.
Yeah, when she first finds out about the Cassiar, she's like, out of here. You know, that's...
Yeah. She crosses paths because of the mining towns, you know. So, you know, Tombstone is that iconic town of Tombstone. We all can rattle off sort of the names of the people that are the legendary of Tombstone. And I think what we so often forget is it's a mining town. There's mining going on. There are the stamp mills round the clock that are making a lot of noise, you know. I don't know how anybody could think in Tombstone. First and foremost, it's a mining town. And she sets up there. And then it's kind of a home base. She seems to go and come Tombstone. I think Bisbee's a little bit like that too, right? She kind of comes and goes over a number of years.
She does. Well, you have to remember that Tombstone was also the county seat for quite a while. So that's what kept it going, even when the silver started to die out.
Right,
you know?
That's right.
That's true.
Yeah. And so it was always going to be around, you know. Yeah, she made her forays because the silver was dwindling. I mean, people were leaving. They weren't coming anymore. They were going. So, you know, she had to go too.
Yeah. Well, I think that's where her listening skills got even sharper, because she would, it seems like she learned about how things are going to play out. And if you're going to go, you need to go in, even if you're going with supplies. You're going to build a boarding house and a mercantile and things like that. It's like you got to get there when it's starting. You don't want to get there too late. Sometimes she'd hear about a strike and it was already kind of on the, you know, on the outs. And she wouldn't go.
Right, right. Yeah, strike while the iron is hot there.
Yeah.
Because sometimes these things played out really fast. Especially silver. I mean, and she was really after gold. I mean, gold was the ultimate. But, you know, gold's hard to find. There's a lot of silver in the West. There's not that much gold anymore in comparison. Mm-hmm. So when the Harquah Hollis had a big gold strike,
It
was kind of interesting. She formed friendships with other men. Other miners, would-be miners, without much trouble, and she always seemed to find people she could work with that were not, that, you know, they were pretty good guys. They were not necessarily bad people, and they go on these forays up to the mines, and all of a sudden she was the leader of the pack. Yeah. I always thought that was very interesting.
Yeah, they'd buy claims for her. Like they would, she'd be like, you know what I'm going to be looking for? That, yep, Nellie, we got you covered. It's like that's so unusual.
You know, I also wanted to make it clear, because I think sometimes you see so many Westerns that are written with, you know, these cowboys that are, you know, going in and taking over the homestead and, you know, just doing terrible things, you know, assaulting the women and all this. Actually, they were a bunch of pretty polite guys, most of them. I mean, there was no, it's not, you know, and I think I found that out with a lot of research I did at Dodge City, too. They tipped their hat. They said, good morning, ma'am. How, may I hold the door for you? Whatever. Yeah, they weren't mean and terrible, you know. They appreciated and respected women. And I think she sort of demanded that respect, and she got it.
Mm-hmm. Well, she was a good cook.
You know,
I think
she was a good cook. I mean, there's no doubt about that. There's this coffee house in San Francisco, Shepherd's Cafe or something like it. It seems like every few after they came back from an escapade, and a few months later, they would all just accidentally meet again at the coffee shop and plan the next venture.
Well, yeah. I'm not necessarily sure. I sort of did an amalgamation of a bunch of different coffee shops and places they might hang out. Say on Mission Street, across the street from where they printed the newspaper about the mining. Mm-hmm. So it was all very convenient, and everybody just kind of hung.
Sure. Yeah. She also was a bit of a, not a doctor. She sort of understood first aid and other kinds of emergency medical things. And she understood scurvy, didn't she?
Absolutely. I mean, she took to nursing just like a duck to water. Because I think when you're in places like Pioche or Tombstone or any, you know, Mouille Hay or any of the places, you have to be able to fix yourself and fix other people with minor injuries at least. And you learn early on that the worst thing that can happen and likely to happen if all you're going to eat is sourdough biscuits and elk, you're going to get scurvy. And she saw that, picked up on it right away. Because it was known. I mean, my goodness, we've had people on pirate ships with scurvy for a couple of hundred years. We knew what caused it.
What scurvy was, right.
Yeah. We knew who cured it, too. So, you know, and she knew it's the same principle. If you're stuck in a place where you can't get fresh fruits and vegetables, you're going to have this disease. It's going to happen. I mean, it's going to happen to you because you can't just eat flour and meat, you know.
You know, you're right, but I'd say for most of those miners, it didn't seem like they really knew that. And
I think they did.
You know, she
didn't believe that could happen to them.
Well, I mean, one of the things I was amazed at was her organizational skill when it comes to planning an expedition. She always knew what to take, what equipment, what food to take, how much, you know. And I thought that was a skill in itself.
Absolutely, yeah.
That's true, but she did have some people like, you know, her buddy Patrick Sullivan and the she was with. They knew. They'd done it before. So, I mean, and she had stopped the stores in Pioche and Tombstone. She knew what they bought. She knew, you know, so she was not a novice when it came to that. But, I mean, we've seen the equipment list. Well, I've seen Western Mounted Police in Canada going up the Chilicoot Pass, 2,500 pounds worth of supplies and food, or you were turned away.
Yeah. Is that the picture on the cover? There's a picture behind her portrait. Is that, say again where this is and yeah.
That is the Chilicoot Pass that's in the climb. Right. And you got to get to the top of that. And after that, it's another, I don't remember, 600 miles to Dawson.
Yeah. To Dawson City, right? To Dawson, yeah.
That's just the beginning. I mean, the pass is just the beginning.
Right, right. And that gets you initially, eventually when you're there, you're in the Klondike area, is that right?
Yes.
Yes, okay, I have that. Because we followed her around a lot in the West and in the Northwest.
Maps. I mean, I had maps that I always do this when I'm writing about a place. I like I print out maps of it. So I know how long it's going to take them to get from point A to point B. And if there's a river or a dog sled or how they have to get there. You know, I remember when I wrote Lily, I went down to the Phoenix Library and sat there all day looking up train schedules, figuring when they built the railroad and how and why and when it opened, you know. So did you have to take a stagecoach from here to here, or could you take a train, or were you just on horseback? Or So I love these little details, and I try to get them right. So
well, and they make for such interesting reading, you know, too. There was one story that you told, and we just wanted to verify that this is perhaps an actual story. She meets a miner and saves him from scurvy. She doesn't think much of it. That's like, that's what I'm just here. It's what I'm doing. I've got, you know, limes and lemons and sauerkraut, and that's what's going to give you. And she just sort of moves on, and he says his name to her. And his name was, we have it in our notes. Let me see. Let me get it here. John Griffith Cheney.
Yes.
And then later he reintroduces himself, and I believe this is a real story about her. Yes,
As far as I know, yes, it is.
Yes. So who is he?
He came to say goodbye and thank her for saving his life, because he was going to go back to the States and he was going to write books, but he wanted a snappier name, and so he took on the name Jack London.
Lazy, huh?
This book is full of little delightful surprises like that, by the way. Yeah, that's really fun. And then you were so intrigued. You wanted to know. Jim went online and he was like, yep, he did have scurvy.
Yep.
Oh, so fun. There's another thing about her that we haven't really touched on yet, but certainly we can't talk about her without acknowledging that this is a woman of great faith and of prayer, and that she loved having the gold nugget in her hand. You know, she had the itch to get out there and look at the claim and figure it all out and so forth. But she was not a greedy woman at all. She gave a lot of her findings away, didn't she?
Almost all of it. Always. I mean, she never expected her partners to do that, and she made no claims on them to do it, but for her share, yes, she gave most of it away to either the church or hospitals or just helping people out. And that's who she was. Mm-hmm. She always wanted to make things better for everybody around her.
She had a real heart for community, and she really didn't think much of it. She was not embarrassed by it, but she didn't really want to have a lot of attention from it, and it seemed. And she would just say, she also was a great fundraiser, wasn't she? Because she donated a lot, but she got
people to donate. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, she did.
She actually used to go around to all the saloons and the gambling, and she would wait until they had a big pot on the table, and she'd step in and go, "Hey, boys, how about donating half of that to the church and the hospital?"
Yeah.
And half the time they'd give it to her.
Yeah.
You know? And she got the herbs. She got everybody to help with her fundraising efforts and tombstones. She just would put on entertainments and walk right into the saloon and say, "Hey, you know, you guys are made so much money tonight. Give me some of it. Let's have a little care.
Yeah, that was fun. I think she also kind of reasoned with them that one of these days you're going to need medical care. Or you are going to need something from the church. I mean, you may not feel you need it now, but your time is coming.
Yeah, it comes from all of us.
Well, it's kind of amazing. You know, she'd build restaurants and boarding houses, on her own and with other people, and put other people in charge. But, you know, we're talking about building churches. We're talking about building hospitals. It's really kind of amazing.
Well, she didn't do it single-handedly, but...
No, that's true.
But every little bit helps. And, you know, she also ran her own free clinics in the back of the restaurant everywhere she lived.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Well, there was the one little story where supposedly, and they may have just been in town at the same time, but Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid make a very small appearance. And when Sheriff Behan finds out about it, which surprised me because I didn't remember that he was in Tombstone so long. It's like he's a major player, you know, in 1881, and then he sort of seems like he drifts out of the story, but he doesn't.
No, we don't care about him anymore.
Yeah. And when he kind of complains, like, how come you didn't tell me? And she's like, you know, I will feed. And then she goes on a little litany, you know, I will feed anybody that respects me and respects my staff and is polite and come in. They can be a bank robber or a bank owner, you know, I treat them all the same. Sure. And I thought, you know, I like that.
Yeah. If you were her, it didn't matter how much money you had. Hit the road.
Yeah.
She wouldn't put up with that. Why should she?
Yeah. Late in her life, she does find she has a mining idea, and she is really going to need investors. And she takes the train and crosses the country and goes into New York City. And she hadn't been in the East in like years.
Tell us
a little bit about that trip and about her time in New York with those three banks she called on.
For all I know, there may have been six banks. I would just, you know,
yeah,
a little bit. So, yeah, I do know there is some record of the fact that she stayed at this particular hotel, and but that's pretty much all I had to work with. So I just kind of went with it. But I also had done quite a bit of research on the Gilded Age of New York, and so I knew what to expect and what they looked like, and you know, this kind of thing. And she didn't have much success with the banks because they're run by men and they're not used to the mining business in the West. And certainly not a woman doing this, completely out of their bailiwick. And, you know, I think a lot of times, even today, that the East Coast and the West Coast in this country don't really know what each other's thinking. Have you ever run across that?
Yeah, there's some truth in that.
Yes. Yes, I've often wondered why we don't put back into Central Park some of the animals that would have lived there, you know, before it became Central Park.
I agree with you. They're wolves, but deer, you know.
Yeah. Oh, buddy. We're going to take one very quick break, a little ad about Out West Shop. And when we come back, we're going to kind of wrap up with a little bit of process questions, find out what's coming next, and stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Here at the Out West Shop, we're passionate about the American West, the truth and the myth. We're purveyors of can wear based on their own love for the story of the West.
Welcome back to Rendezvous with the Writer with special guest Kathleen Morris. We're talking about Nellie Cashman, the gold digger.
So fun.
And she did bring home some gold, as I remember in the book. Yeah. I'm kind of amazed.
Oh, so fun.
Sort of after she says goodbye to somebody.
And, you know, she just knew everybody. John Clum, and, I mean, you could throw out a name. She could have been a name dropper. Oh, so Kathleen, were you, in all of your research and in the writing, were there surprises, things you didn't expect that revealed themselves to you?
Yeah, there really were. I figured she was very capable and, you know, she had this reputation as a saint, but she was also extremely down to earth. She got her hands dirty. She didn't have any airs or anything about her, and the dog sled stuff.
Yes. Oh my gosh.
When they did a 750-mile journey on a dog sled in what, I don't know, I'd have to look up my stats here, but in 9 days or something, it's like, what? I mean, it's like something out of a movie. And this was routine for her.
Yeah, she just, okay.
It was.
Okay, we'll just hook up the dogs. And she had her favorite dog, Chris. And we'll just go. And I thought, oh, my God.
And never with a weapon. Most of the time alone. Just her and six or eight dogs. And, yeah.
Amazing. Yeah.
Her dog was extremely well-treated. And she loved those dogs. And, they lasted longer than your average sled dog. So
yes, yeah. Yes, you do bring that. You bring that up. She treated them. Let's see. Did she bring them in? She treated them a little bit differently. They got a little nicer. And they were treated. Not that they weren't treated nicely by others, but she kind of catered to them a little more.
You know, if you were a dog, would you rather be sleeping out on a snowbank or at least in a pen where you could have some access to get a little more warmth
I'd go for warmth.
Yeah.
A couple of those dogs just took to her naturally. Yeah, they figured out it's their favorite right away.
Yeah, Chris right away. Yeah. Let's see. Do you have a favorite place you like to write in?
Oh golly. I used to love to write down at the ranch, but I haven't been down there in a couple of years, you know. But I'm pretty content with my little study nook here, where I just I got everything, nice big window, and I can't wait for the summer to be over so I can open that nice big window. I just, as long as I have that, I'm good.
Do you write? Are you a very disciplined writer where you write, you know, every day something, some amount of something, or is it as you have time or as the muse moves you?
No, I try to write every day, and it's not because I'm disciplined, because I'm really not, but I just find myself, I find almost it forces me in something. I'll sit down and I'm like, should I check the news or my email? I'm like, no, those three pages I wrote yesterday, and let me take a look at those. So I go back and, you know, do a little editing, and then one thing leads to another, and before I know it, I've got a couple more. So, I don't know.
Yeah.
Do you have a process question? I know you always do.
A process. You know, I was going to ask about speed of process. Yeah. I was going to ask about the cover. There's some significance in our cover here. Who took the picture?
We determined what the photo was of, but how did you decide the composite for that?
Oh, we went around and around and around on this. I have a great tech media guy that is just, he's fantastic. He does the artwork. He did the artwork for Chilliqoot. You know, he based it on a picture. And then what he did is he drew it based on that and embellished it and put color in and all that. And he's just terrific. I mean, he's wonderful. He enhanced the letters too. So if you have, you know, the old letters that she had written, like a great nephew, if you have Kindle and it's on, an e-screen, you can, you know, magnify them and you can read them very well.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah, because he cleaned them up so well. And he did a nice job on some photographs, too.
Yeah.
He did a wonderful job with those. In fact, Michael Cunningham in the bank, when we first got that picture, you couldn't even tell who it was. But he worked with it and brought out all the features. And it's wonderful.
Yes. What are you working on next?
Oh, I'm working on a little thriller type.
Oh.
Yeah, it's kind of a family story, family drama thriller. 70s and 80s.
Oh, sounds good. And do you ever get writer's block?
No, I actually don't. I'll just have times when I don't feel like writing, but I wouldn't call it a block.
Yeah.
So.
Jim always likes to find a couple quotes, and we're going to go ahead. And Jim, why don't you share what you found for this broadcast?
Okay.
I always like to get one from the story and one to tie it together. Yeah, later in life, a reporter asked Nellie why she never married. She replies, "Why, child, I haven't had the time for marriage. Men are a nuisance anyhow." Now, aren't they? They are just boys grown up. And then from the poet Robert Service, "I have clenched and closed with the naked north. I have learned to defy and defend. Shoulder to shoulder, we have fought it out. Yet the wild must win in the end."
Kathleen, this has been so lovely to have this time to chat with you. Thank you so much for making the time to join us tonight. We really appreciate it. And we look forward to reading whatever you have coming up next.
Oh, good, good.
How do people find you?
Yeah, how do people find you?
You can find my books, any of them, on Amazon. They're also for sale on Barnes & Noble and some bookstores. You can order them from Ingram Park if you have an indie bookstore. So they're all over the place, you know, Kobo and that. And yeah, and my website's KathleenMorrisAuthor.com.
Yeah, and social media too. And so we really thank you for being with us. And we thank Sam Hassan, owner and our engineer of LA Talk Radio. We thank the Hot Texas Swing Band. We thank all of you that have joined us. And we hope you will join us again next week when our guest is Gene Cooney. And we will be discussing a cozy murder mystery. It's murder, don't you know? A quirky murder mystery with recipes. I'm excited to be getting into this story. And let's see, Jim, what else?
It's always a great day out west.
See you Thank next you. Week. Thank you, Kathleen.
Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed this. Thank
it's
you.
It's been fun. So Thank you.
We'll talk to you down the road.
You guys are great.
You're listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell.